Thank you for listening to this forum podcast. Please check out our website for a rich archive of podcasts and writing from contemporary philosophers and other researchers on a wide variety of topics. The Forum is an educational charity dedicated to bringing academic philosophy to a broader audience. Please consider donating to us via our Just Giving page, which you can find on our website. Happy listening.
Hello, I'm Shahida Bari. I'm one of the fellows of the Forum, and I'm your chair tonight. This event is titled The Age of the Algorithm. I'm going to preface our conversation with a quick note about, well, thank you for coming in this inclement weather, but also through the strike. So, as you know, the University and Colleges Union is engaged in industrial action, and the Forum, many members of the Forum, Beth included, and myself, are academics. And we're currently striking. I'm currently on strike at my institution, which is Queen Mary University of London, as you know, we're striking over pensions. But I thought it was worth noting that we decided to run this event today after some consideration, because those of you who come regularly know that the Forum events are part of a programme of public engagement that we do. And the Forum is a charity that is independent of institutional and certainly academic support, financially or other. So it's important for us to run the event, and for that reason we consider our event exempt from the industrial action. But I would like to take this opportunity, and I'm sure the panellists will agree, that we want to signal our support of the UCU and the strike at the moment. So just let's do a preparatory note, first of all. But today's event is about algorithms, the machines that are going to be taking over our jobs, probably. Hands up if any of you are on Tinder, Bumble or Grindr. All of you. The ubiquity of dating apps is just one indication of the ways in which we entrust our lives to algorithmic calculations, from the targeted marketing of political campaigns to the predictive typing that preempts your Google searches. Machines seem to know us better than we know ourselves. At the same time, we seem to be plagued by anxieties about the way algorithms manipulate and perhaps even endanger our free will. Now, these are philosophical questions as well as the concerns of our modern life, hence our debate today. So joining us to discuss are Abebe Berhane, a postgraduate researcher in cognitive science at University College Dublin. She blogs regularly about embodied cognition and the enactive approach to cognitive science on her website, which has this very charming tagline, anti-Cartesian rants, comma, mainly. Neil Lawrence is a professor at the University of Sheffield. He's currently on leave and working instead at Amazon. He's issued a disclaimer that he's not responsible for any of your late deliveries, so please ask him about it. But he is the director of machine learning there. And he's also the founder of Amazon Research Cambridge. And he also has a blog, inverseprobability.com. You don't have a tagline, but you do have some charming photos of your son and mother planting seeds, and I think that might be an analogy that we'll come to at some point. And then lastly, not leastly, Martin Robbins. Martin is head of product at FactMata, which is an organisation committed to building a better media ecosystem. He's also the author of Raising Hal, a blog about AI, and he's written about data and tech for The Guardian, Vice and Little Atoms. And in fact, if any of you followed Vice's big expose of the data crunchers Cambridge Analytica last year and their apparent role in the US election, you might also have read Martin's very excellent critique of that story in turn in Little Atoms. Okay, so the format is as follows. I'm sure lots of you already know this. I question our speakers on the subject of algorithms and machine learning. We'll eventually open up the floor to you guys. But I just thought, before I ask you those questions, I'm slightly throwing you all because I haven't told you this, but I thought, because this is such an abstract topic, algorithms and machine learning, so I wondered if each of you could sketch out very briefly the parts of our lives where you think machine intelligence or an algorithm has had a really profound or powerful impact. I don't know if any of you could do that.
I don't think we're the right people for that kind of question, really. Do you mean like personally or everyone?
For all of us, yeah.
For all of us. After you, Neil, I'm sure you've got some profound thoughts on.
I think that there's an interesting perception that this is a new thing. One of the things I like to think about is if you go back to stockbroking, that used to be a thing. Anyone here a stockbroker? I mean, they don't really exist anymore. They were sort of replaced by algorithms. You didn't see them on the street begging, We did have some interesting effects, like algorithmic trading led to big market crashes in the mid-80s. So I guess the thing I'd like to say, and some of the most interesting work about what it means to have data stored about you was written in the 70s. So I'd say it's not a new phenomenon, yeah. But perhaps it's getting closer to us with our mobile phones.
Yeah, I think the obvious thing I could think about is Google Maps. For me, it's an algorithm. It's developed on data, on algorithms. So for me, that has transformed my life. I think everybody here relies on things like that. But then again, as you said, they are ubiquitous. They are everywhere. They are in the social sphere. They are in the courtrooms. They are in the education system. Whether someone gets a job or not is judged and weighed by algorithms. So
there. That's a very helpful example. I think those examples will emerge as we begin our discussion. Ebeba, you're going to start because I thought we'd get you to talk first because you work both in philosophy and in cognitive science. And I wondered if you could set up the nature of the relationship between the two. And I think the question I want to ask you is philosophy and the philosophical notions of personhood that philosophy produces, are those things up to the task of making sense of machine intelligence?
Yeah, good question. So philosophy and science, we usually approach philosophy and science as if they are something separate and something distinct, something that exists completely independent of each other. And sometimes even philosophy and science are compared as if one is better than the other, and questions such as, is philosophy or science better to answer such and such questions? I think that's any good philosopher or any good scientist knows that that's a false dichotomy. That's just unhelpful because philosophy and science are interrelated. They develop together. They depend on one another. And one of the greatest, today's greatest philosopher, Daniel Dennett, has put this beautifully. He has said, there is no such thing as philosophy-free science, but rather science that whose baggage has been cleared and that we have taken on board without questioning its assumption or something to that extent. And I couldn't agree with him anymore. And even bringing in my own experience, I see myself as both a scientist and a philosopher. As you said, I'm in cognitive science, and cognitive science back in University College Dublin is run by the School of Philosophy and the School of Computer Science. So I work both with philosophers and scientists, and it's so obvious and so clear to me that we need interdisciplinarity. We need philosophers and scientists talking to each other and asking questions. We can't do without philosophy. Just coming back to machine intelligence itself, if you want to develop some sort of machine intelligence, or if you even want to talk about machine intelligence, you have to first clarify what machine intelligence is, and you have to define it, which brings us back to philosophy. And it's not also, we don't just define and then we specify and then we go and study it. It's not as if the science is final and finished and then we move on. It's with everything else, our sciences also change, our interests change, our values change. So it's important to go back to the philosophy and reevaluate and reassess our definitions and our assumptions. And again, coming back to my own experience as well as academic staff, I also work with students. I teach data ethics to computer science students, data science students, data ethics and critical thinking, and I teach general introduction to ethics to philosophy. Well, it's something we are trying currently in the School of Computer Science in University College Dublin. So it's mainly
block or
no. What we are trying to do, myself and my supervisor are trying to do is, and the head of school trying to do is to get the students to think about whether there is such a thing as neutral technology, or whether data can be biased, or whether there's such thing as raw data, or whether how we look for problems, or where we look for problems, how we define our problems has implications, and questions as what is ethical data, and what does it mean to be ethical, what's fairness, and who does the work this data science do, who does it impact, questions like that. So it started last summer, and this semester we have it up and running, and so the contrast is really stark with my philosophy students and my data science students. With the data science students, you see, as long as their codes are perfect, they don't want to concern themselves with, oh, what's ethical, or why should I think about correlation and causation, or why should I think about whether third parties are going to come and use my algorithms in a way that I didn't intend to. Questions like that, they see them as philosophical and not something that they need to deal with. And what we are trying to do is to get them to think about these questions, because as we said at the beginning, algorithms are everywhere. The softwares and algorithms these computer scientists develop are being used in the hospitals, in the courtrooms, they are affecting voting processes. So it's important to incorporate and to think about social issues, not just coding.
I can see exactly why that is the case as a philosopher,
yeah,
and someone who's watched the kind of political landscape alter in the last couple of years for particular reasons, which we might talk about. But how do they take it when you do your computer scientists find themselves in moral crises, or what happens?
At the beginning, I found it really difficult to engage with them because they simply are not interested. And last semester, what we did was make it carry a heavy grade, so it was 20% of So 20%. Then they started engaging, and they started also getting interested. And one of the toughest questions is, even when they are interested, even when we have these open conversations, their question is, okay, so I can see how this could be a problem, or I can see what I'm doing could impact a certain demographic or a certain group of people, but why should it be up to me? Why won't the people who are going to employ me, why isn't it up to them? Why shouldn't you go and have the same conversation with them? And I don't know the answer to that, but that's a really interesting question. Who is responsible?
Yeah, I think that they're deferring the responsibility to, or they're delegating the responsibility to a user or the people who implement the software rather than make the software.
I think it's a fair question. They do carry some of the responsibility, but not all of it. And you have to be fair as well. You don't want to make them think it's all up to them. It's up to everybody. It's up to every citizen and individual to be aware, to make ourselves aware. But it's also up to the organizations and companies to be responsible and to think these things through.
Yeah. Neil, I wonder if you've got any response to that as one of those heartless, amoral data scientists.
I think it's not... So it's very challenging, right? Because one of the ways we automate systems is we compartmentalize them. So we take a process and we try and say, oh, we can take this component and we can automate that. And that goes back to sort of like manufacturing the Ford Model T or Sheffield, where I'm from, how they made cutlery. They did it in different places. And of course, this brings about an isolation between those who are making some of these decisions and those who are being affected by these decisions. And I think that that's a big challenge. And it's also hard if the data ethics course doesn't resonate with the people. They don't understand why that's the case. But, you know, I think we're seeing good examples in terms of the consequences of this now. So it should be, somehow it should be easier to explain to people why this is important.
What do you mean by examples? What have you in mind?
Well, I think there's a lot of concern now about, you know, we're seeing, for example, a lot of the Russian interference in the US election is, you know, and this is all, I haven't read the details about it, but one of the cases is that there was an influence by spending money on particular advertising and Twitter bots reinforcing divisions in society. Now, that's interesting because that's humans actually interfering in a system which is manipulable. And then, of course, you want algorithmic defenses. But, you know, you sort of see, I think that there's a history to these sort of things. There's a history from statistics where, I love the quote, there's lies, damned lies, and statistics. Now, that quote is a Mark Twain quote from the turn of the century, but he's crediting it to Disraeli. Whether that's true, Disraeli said it or not. But the point is that that predates the mathematical analysis and understanding of fairness and proof in statistics. It comes from a time when people were just summing up numbers and making broad claims, not that that happens at all today. But in areas like sort of drugs trials or in, you know, there are standards for well-designed experiments that, you know, I mean, there are problems. Ben Goldacre talks a lot about them. But there are standards about how you should do these things. And I think we're just entering another era where the nature of the data we're getting is somewhat different. And we're having to think through those things again. And it's not easy, because it's not easy for someone to understand all the computer science they need, get a sense of how data works, and then understand a wide society of ethical issues. And the really interesting part about it is that when people were just doing these things on a small scale, often it didn't matter so much that their algorithm had a bit of bias in it, something like that, because they were deploying in a small scale. But when you were deploying it across a billion people, it matters a lot, right? So you know, those systems can be manipulated because of the scale they're operating at and because they're just computer code, so humans can manipulate. And this really changes the way we think. Historically in statistics, I've done a lot of things with statisticians. Statisticians are always nervous to talk about the conclusions of the model. For example, we were doing a workshop on spatial disease and in particular monitoring of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa. And we had the leading authority in malaria there. And when he was presenting his latest speculative model, he asked for the camera to be switched off. Not because he was embarrassed about what he was going to say, but because what he says about where malaria is and the effect of net programs in Uganda and Kenya leads to decisions being made, hundreds of millions of dollars being spent, or decisions about, you know, how large charities are doing their business. So when he was making a speculative claim, he's very conscious, now I shut up. Statisticians are always conscious of that, because this one thing they're going to say is going to result in deaths or large money spend or whatever like that. It's much harder when a data scientist, well, all I'm doing is classifying a face. Yeah. Now, when it turns out that face classification works better for some races than others, and you've deployed it, you know, across the world, and that you've therefore basically discriminated against a subsection of population, then there's a problem. But it's not so immediately obvious to the algorithm designer.
Is that right, Martin, as a journalist and as someone who's been surveying this landscape, that the scalability of the algorithm and its range, the range of its deployment, has made it a much more pressing problem for us?
Yes and no. So I agree completely that the scalability of an algorithm is one of the key sort of ratchets for the influence that it has on the world. That's kind of a pretty obvious thing. One of the best ways to completely derail a conversation is to get bogged down in definitions. So kind of in that mm-hmm. spirit, I think it's really important to sort of step back and just say, what do we actually mean by an algorithm? And in a very sort of abstract sense, we're just talking about a sort of a sequence of instructions that's being replicated at some kind of scale. And that's not a particularly new thing, and it's not a particularly new thing at a scale of billions of people. Neil mentioned the Model T Ford. You can look at things like McDonald's, for example. The success of Ray Kroc in spreading that franchise was around coming up with a specific set of instructions and rolling that out on a colossal scale that had never really been seen before. That, much like Facebook today, then led to a whole load of unforeseen consequences, mainly people getting very fat and unhealthy. And then sort of in order to try and sort of deal with that, you know, suddenly we've got an obesity crisis, suddenly people are talking about, oh, you know, we're gonna, you know, McDonald's are gonna start selling salads now, and that's gonna make everyone, you know, and there's a bit of apple in the pies, and that's, you know, that's nutrition, and everyone will be fine again. Shockingly, that didn't really work particularly well. and McDonald's is still there and everyone's still getting fat. And I think there's kind of a lesson there. One of the things that I really kind of reject as a central premise is the idea that, you know, we built something like Facebook and now there's like a problem and we just have to kind of fix the problem. Like, you know, people talk about fake news as if it's like, oh, well, you know, we had Facebook and Twitter and they were fine until 2 years ago. And then, oh, suddenly, you know, there was the Brexit thing happening and Nigel Farage and some nasty people did some bad things on social media and that ruined it. And, you know, then the Russian trolls came along and suddenly, you know, Facebook wasn't good and they bought ads and X, Y, Z. But that doesn't get into the point that these systems, much like McDonald's before it, much like the Model T Ford and internal combustion engines before that, are things that were fundamentally flawed from the start and had serious negative consequences that are baked into that fundamental design that you can't simply just, you know, post hoc design your way out of. I think that's the key thing. And, you know, a lot of the issues we're seeing now, you know, again, looking at another term, sort of artificial intelligence, and a lot of the fear about, you know, how do we govern kind of big, uncontrollable systems that are making decisions on behalf of humanity with potentially negative consequences. I don't want to sound all kind of Jeremy Corbyn, but we already have those systems. They're called massive corporations. And I'm not saying that in a kind of, you know, all capitalism is bad kind of sense. And I'm also not saying it in a kind of abstract philosophical sense. I mean that in a very practical sense. Like, we're already wrestling with these problems. And one of the things I find kind of a little bit frustrating about the whole discussion around algorithms and AI is that the complexity of the technology involved has almost sort of allowed a kind of mythology to build up around these companies and what they're doing. And the fact that, you know, oh, Google's going to create a superhuman AI that's going to, you know, ruin the world someday. Google already is a superhuman, artificially intelligent entity. It's already making decisions that affect millions, billions of people on a daily basis. And there's a frighteningly small amount of kind of governance and oversight when it comes to actually how those decisions are made and the impacts that we had. And we probably won't know all of the impacts for, you know, probably even by the ends of our lifetimes. There'll still be stuff that's coming out about the effects of this.
I might probe you a bit later about the difference between an egg McMuffin and Google Maps. But I want to, thank you, Rebecca. I want to move on to Neil, because just to go back to these, to take a few steps back, to go back to these definitions. Neil, I want to ask you to set out some of the differences or the distinctions between natural intelligence and artificial intelligence, because I think you understand that relationship as you understand it in ways that are not obvious and quite striking, I think.
So, yeah, just to Martin's definition, I agree a lot with what Martin said about the sort of scope. One, that term algorithm is definitely how a computer scientist sees it, but I think the term has come to take on a different meaning amongst the wider population, which is very much driven by algorithms that combine data and models together. So in some sense, your data is being used. So it just, I think a lot of the public think of it that way, although your definition is the sort of computer science one. But yeah, coming back to the natural intelligence versus artificial intelligence, I think that I really dislike artificial intelligence as a term, and I've thought about it a fair amount. And then I've tried to help people understand what the differences are by describing some differences between natural and artificial intelligence. And I think, broadly speaking, the ones I wanted to touch on today, there's two. One is contextual, and one I think is more systemic. So one is to do with the way they're being produced. So let's start with the systemic one. So that is that natural intelligences that we have are very much evolved. And if anything's evolved, it basically has this first rule, don't fail. We operate in an extremely uncertain, dynamic environment, and the challenges we're going to get faced with on a day-to-day basis are varying all the time. And one of the, and this is true for natural systems in general, evolutionary systems. I mean, when you can see that evolution, when you look at computational biology and look at the way the cells evolved, very specifically saying evolved, not designed, there's enormous redundancy in it. Because, of course, the cell has had to deal with failures brought about by uncontrolled environmental conditions and a need to, well, it doesn't have a need to, but if it doesn't survive, we don't see it. It's a very simple thing. I mean, Darwinism is like, well, if it didn't work, it disappears. So the ones that didn't have redundancy and flexibility don't exist. So their first sort of goal is, I mean, they don't have a goal. It's not really a goal, but we only see them if they didn't fail.
Yeah, so you have to survive.
You have to survive in order to be seen today. It's not that intelligence needs to survive. You could have a good intelligence that is trying to do something else, but if it didn't, if it's not there, then, you know, we don't see it. So the natural intelligences we see are also subject to these influences, and they're super flexible. And I think that the interesting thing is then they may become efficient a particular task after they've ticked this, I'm flexible enough to, like, someone threw a ball at me and I blocked it away and did all these other things, and then, oh my goodness, I'm in the meeting talking about AI and there's microphones and electronics and there's a computer. Wow. I mean, all this stuff we can do is super flexible to our changing environment. If you look at the way we automate in practice, all these examples that were named, we control the environment first. You remove that uncertainty, right? So the systems that we design and deploy, the first thing you do is you say, well, I'm going to control the environment around them. So good candidates for AI solutions are things where there's a sort of, compartmentalized thing where I can say, put something in here, protect it from complexity on the outside.
Like get from Hoban to the LSE.
Yeah, you know, on a map where we've got all the information, as was mentioned before, and I've got all the routing, now I can deploy a pathfinding algorithm very easily and do that. I've controlled, and that's why we can do so much, because we're controlling things in mobile phones. But the AIs we're designing, and these are designed, and most design things are designed efficiently. So what you'll see is when humans design things, we very rarely put large amounts of redundancy in unless there's safety criticality, like an aircraft. We tend to have very efficient processes that are sort of algorithmic, as Martin was describing, the rollout of the way you do that at scale is you just do this. You know, that's the seven things. Don't you come in with your natural intelligence and start thinking about this. Follow these instructions. Yeah. That's not very natural for humans, but that's how you make something very efficient. Of course, that efficient thing, when it's exposed to some disruption, when, you know, Martin's persuaded everyone about the dangers of eating these things, it just fails because it's not adaptable. And that's the systemic sort of just the consequences of the way they've been brought about, that, you know, one, you're trying to put the minimal resource in to achieve a very set task, and the other one gets to do that once it's worked out how to just procreate. So that's one, I think, of the systemic thing.
You make us sound amazing, and artificial intelligence sound like the Dalek that hits the stairs.
Yeah, I mean, we are amazing. I mean, all of us. And actually everything around us. The natural world is amazing. It's beautiful. And I think that the reason we're fascinated by AI, and the reason it's a bad term, but also there is an interesting side to it, is understanding AI just gets us a better understanding of ourselves. Like, if you go back to Turing, the cybernetics people like this, they worried about how do humans think. They tried to put it in logical terms. It turns out, no, it's not like that. You just get deeper and deeper into what it is about us. And I think that's beautiful. And I think that, you know, that's what the philosophy to science, the possibility for interaction. I mean, we are compartmentalized in these fields, in cognitive science, but all the interesting stuff is going to happen at the interface, which is actually the most sparsely populated
portion of
these fields.
I quite agree with you about the complexity and ambiguity of reality. Mm. And this is a section of my PhD, actually. What I'm proposing is we have this Cartesian approach to the mind or the person, which is very, autonomous and self-determined and self-sustaining kind of independent entity that we have inherited from Descartes, even from before. And the way we think about humans is as if something that, you know, that exists on an island, we kind of move away, we discard the ambiguities and the complexities of reality. But when you think about it, we can't exist. There is no mind independent of others. We need others. Mm-hmm. We need relationships. We need interactions, even in order to know our own selves, to know who we are. Our sense of selves comes from what others tell us, what we get from others, and how we interact and how we communicate with others. So others and relationships and acknowledging these complex realities is really important. And what Descartes was trying to do in attempting to establish this clear ground, this completely certain ground, was to kind of define and just get rid of uncertainties, and that didn't help because reality is not like that.
That sounds like you're saying that Descartes is the Dalek. There's something relational and networky about human beings already. But that begs the question, I think, that you're getting to here, which is that we're finessing machine intelligence to the point that it's able to isolate specifically what's brilliant and unique about us. What is that thing?
Well, I don't think it isolates it. I think as we study it, we get further into... I think, you know, Descartes didn't see computers, didn't know about Turing, didn't know about all these things. So these are wonderful thoughts in the time, and we're just really lucky because we communicate, because we can share ideas. And I think that that's the second fundamental difference is that contextual one that I think you were touching on. And just to sort of look at the mathematics of it is... the way in which we are constrained to communicate. So coming back to one of the reasons the natural world is beautiful is actually the way things do extraordinary things in the face of constraints. Or, you know, why do they end up doing these amazing, you know, a colleague of mine once said, if plants had property rights, the world would just be covered in grass. I'm not sure that's true, but what he meant was that if you were just trying to most efficiently use the power of the sun, you wouldn't cheat by growing up. You would just say, let's cover everything in solar panels, you know, in the most efficient way, have them tilt a bit. But if you're shading someone else, you're just not using the sun efficiently. Now, we could have that, but it's not a very interesting world. So I think that, you know, because you don't have those communication constraints, all the plants don't agree, let's share equally the sun, you get these interesting things happening. Now, in humans, we're in a very interesting position. It's a very big difference between us and the machine intelligences we build. I call it the sort of embodiment factor of these things. It relates to sort of embodied cognition. But a computer, if you were trying to simulate the human brain in terms of all its actions, you would require a computer which is about the size of the Met Office computer, which I think costs $250 million, and it's like the 11th fastest computer in the world. Simulates our weather every day, predicted we were going to be frozen in, everything else. Simulates also the climate, does all these things. And you would need a computer that size to simulate our brain, which is a lot faster than a regular computer. Regular computers slower than that, but the interesting thing, so our, you know, if we try and use that as a proxy for how much computation we do, and when I'm saying computation, I'm not thinking like our times tables, I'm talking about the neurons firing at the low level, the stuff that is below our consciousness. There's an incredible amount of computation going on that we don't have access to in our conscious selves or in any other form. If you took a computer, it's got less computation, but it can communicate with a much higher bandwidth. So to put that in context, typical computers communicate less than that, but if you were to take 1 second of computation that a computer did and communicate all of it, it would take you about 20 minutes to do so. So if you, a modern processor at modern sort of Wi-Fi speeds, which sounds slow, but if you were to do the same thing with a human, it would take you 15 billion years. Right. Because computers can communicate at about a gigabit a second, and we can communicate at about 100 bits per second. So this is billionaires versus I've got 100 quid. It's a massive difference, yeah. And it makes an enormous difference in the way the intelligences work. So what we have to do to get over this, because I'm trying to communicate with you now, what I sort of intuitively have inside, you have a sense that you're all humans and you understand the same things as me. So I use analogies. I say small things to try and bring your mind in line with my mind, you know, tell stories or whatever else. But it's all very reliant on having a model of what you're like, which is to your point, and we are defined by what others think about us. And this is like a shared strategy. We all have to agree to do this or else it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. So we have to sort of, in order to predict what's going to happen in a certain circumstance, I have to have a good model of everyone here. Computers don't do that at all. So to me, that drives our sense of self. That drives our ability to operate in a society and how we think in isolation from that. You don't need that in a computer. You never needed that because right from day one, I sometimes call it a locked-in intelligence, right? We're locked in. The computer wasn't really locked in. It can just share everything it sees. It's always talking. Yeah. So it's much more like a sensor network. You know, it's much more like if we distribute 8 of us around the building, we can constantly communicate with each other what we see, and we've got a shared... We don't need to have this very complex way of, oh, maybe Martin doesn't like what I'm saying, maybe he can get angry, you know, maybe he's scratching his thing. You know, all this stuff that I'm processing subconsciously and consciously. Yeah. We don't have to do that in a computer, because it's just like, you know, the way this would work is we would all come in within Wi-Fi range of each other, and we would go, and then we would all leave. It could have been done.
Yeah. That's such an intriguing. From what I can understand, that means basically that we human beings are better computers than computers, but computers are better communicators than we are.
Yes,
that's a very perverse sort of formulation.
But it is. But then there's something that's at the base level. There's another level at which communication. A good communicator among humans is someone who can understand what to say to sort of tweak the other person into thinking the thought that they want. And that becomes very complicated. It's a wonderful game, actually, because imagine we're in a society that's trying to do this, and somehow this thing becomes like the way that we perform sexual selection, how good we are at this. Then all of a sudden, the ones that are best at doing it will typically mate together and produce offspring that are even better at doing it. But then it gets harder, because you're always second-guessing each other. It's sort of like sort of on Russian dolls effect. And you can see how that could lead to runaway intelligence, but it's a social intelligence. That's the thing that gets me about it. If that's true, and I'm not an evolutionary or socio, whatever one of those, anthropologist, I don't even know if they exist. But if that were the case, that would imply that our intelligence is entirely social.
Yeah.
And then there's this side effect that, we can do math.
So I'm going to move on to Martin quickly, but a question for all of you, really. Can we teach our machines to be social? What I mean by that is that if the machine intelligence is driven by the imperative of efficiency, and can we teach it, in the way that the law aspires to justice or fairness, and art aspires to beauty, can we teach the machine to aspire to things that are not efficiency, beauty, fairness, justice?
My own answer is that we end up doing that merely to emulate, to create an interface to the computer that we find easy and responsive to communicate with. I mean, I think that you can never replace. So I dislike the term artificial intelligence, but I like it in the way that it's like an artificial plant. You will make something that looks all right, and maybe it's functional in some ways. Like, I did put some artificial plants in my house. I don't have to water them. That's nice. But it's not the same, and it never can be, because there's this entire co-evolved history of what we are, and you can have a computer emulate by watching humans do it a lot, but it wasn't there. Or we could suck it all out of our heads in some weird way that some people propose and then put it in a computer. I don't know, is it different then? Actually, Turing was fighting this argument, by the way, with the Turing test. Turing test argument was to fight what I'm saying. So, by the way, there is another side, which is like, look, if you were to interface with a computer in such a way that you couldn't tell it wasn't human, then you've created intelligence. So he was trying to fight what I'm saying, which is you can never truly emulate the human intelligence. So I might be wrong about that. Turing is smart.
But it's nice to have a skeptic in the House of Amazon about whether we want our machines to emulate us. It sounds like you don't, interestingly. But I want to move to Martin before we open up to you guys. And I mentioned Martin, the Cambridge Analytica story, which was reported in Vice and was a big story. I think lots of you read it and followed it up avidly with all the inquiries into Russian interference. And you wrote the critique of it about how effectively that targeted marketing could have impacted or affected the outcome of the US election. And I think you're questioning whether data mining really could accomplish something like that. Do you think we're living in it sounds like you don't think we're living in a brave new algorithmic age, because McDonald's were doing it already, was what you're saying, but is our anxiety about this misplaced then? Should we all just relax?
Okay, so let me try and deal with the whole previous conversation and then segue neatly into that. So we've established that computers and human beings are different things, which I think is good. That's a point I think most of us can agree on. Something that really comes out of that is why we're so obsessed with computers being like people in the first place. And something I just really wanted to come into, although it's a little bit of a tangent from the rest, is the extent to which there's kind of a community of people who are obsessed with the idea that like a super intelligence is going to come down from the heavens and rule over the earth, and it's going to grant us immortality by allowing our minds to meld with the computers and the internet and all this kind of thing. And it's hard to look at a lot of that and not see the makings of essentially a kind of machine-based religion. There are even people around the sort of kind of transhumanist, ethical altruist, and so on movement who say that it's possible that we're living in a simulation being run by an AI, and that therefore we should all behave ourselves just in case it turns out it's a logical thing to do. So it's remarkable how we've used this kind of like the search for extraterrestrial life, not just to sort of explore our own intelligence, but to sort of answer some kind of weird, deep-seated psychological human need for a greater power and companionship and so on. Segue. So that brings me on to the sort of, you know, the sheer unlikeliness of big tech companies currently to ever deliver that kind of thing. And I think, you know, I talked about this a lot last year in a TEDx talk that none of you have seen because there were technical problems in the video. I didn't get to post it.
Because the sentient AI prevented it being broadcast.
Exactly. Now the pieces of the puzzle fall into place. Had you seen it? It was amazing. But what's really, really interesting to me about the sort of field of, you know, artificial intelligence, machine learning, whatever you want to call it, is actually the sheer lack of progress being made in any tangible way in the products and the services that we actually use. I was thinking about this the other day. Actually, in response to your question at the beginning, you were saying, you know, what are the things that have really transformed in the age of algorithms? And there are some things like how we consume information. That's been sort of condensed down to a much sort of narrower set of sources for the entire human race than existed previously. But when you look at a lot of those impacts, they're all actually quite old. And when you look at the sites and the services that we use on a daily basis, if Facebook is like 10, 15 years old, Twitter is 10 years old, Wikipedia is 15 years old, Google is 15, 16, 17 years old. You know, even things like sort of Netflix is over 10 years old. If you actually try and find examples of major innovation resulting from AI that's been actually delivered in terms of tangible products that you use on a daily basis in the last 10 years, it's incredibly difficult to do. And actually more than that, a lot of the products that we use in that time, a lot of people would argue that they've deteriorated in quality. So we see, for example, the problems emerging with Facebook and Twitter. People's experiences on those sites are declining, even though Facebook has one of the biggest research teams on the planet in this kind of area. You look at things like Google and their search results and the extent to which they're packed with sort of very clever gimmicks like surfacing Wikipedia articles higher in the rankings that don't necessarily deliver anything that's particularly intelligent. Even when you look at examples of you know, applied machine learning that have had a breakthrough, like things like Siri voice assistants or translation, around voice assistants, a lot of that improvement's been down to improvements in miniaturizing microphones and improved microphone technology. In self-driving cars, one of the reasons why self-driving cars in some respects are more feasible than self-driving trains, when you might think it would be the opposite, is that actually the sensors on cars, the speed that a car moves and the time and distance that it can brake within, the sensors are able to sort of scan that area very quickly, very accurately. On a large freight train that needs like a 2-mile stopping distance, we actually don't really have the sensor technology to cope with those kinds of distances. And so it was all these kinds of areas of advancement where, for whatever the PR departments of these companies are saying, it's not actually necessarily the magic black boxes that are doing it. It's other kind of practical applications. And that was sort of bringing back to the whole story with Cambridge Analytica and the idea that you know, this ability to target ads was, you know, purely what swung elections. That as sophisticated as those technologies are, and I'm certainly not saying that advertising money spent doesn't have an impact, but that I suspect that their ability to target people on that kind of level is somewhat overrated, just purely on the basis of things like, for example, I regularly receive advertisements for height boosting shoes even though I'm 6'1". You know, it's a lot of this, you know, and it comes back to what I was saying at the beginning, that there's this really infuriating lack of skepticism. I'm not saying, by the way, that there's not advances being made and that there aren't interesting things being done and that some products aren't being improved. But there's this just sort of utter lack of skepticism in the face of some of the claims being made that's kind of leading people to assume that some of these companies and businesses are almost wielding like a supernatural ability to influence the course of human affairs. And I just think we need to be a little bit careful of how much we fall for that and end up doing effectively a PR job on behalf of those firms.
So you're saying we ought to be more sceptical that these apparent machine intelligences are not having the effect that they're claiming to. But this is a different question. Should we mobilise algorithms for the purposes of social engineering? You're saying it's not happening or the technology isn't up to it, but should we be doing that? I don't mean we should be rigging elections to anybody, but I think maybe we should we be mobilising algorithms to stop the person who loves McDonald's going to McDonald's and direct them to, you know, the vegan grocer down the road instead? Should we be social engineering with those algorithms?
I mean, we already are. I mean, everything, our whole society is built around social engineering. There's a bunch of people that do it to sell products. Governments use things like, you know, nudge theory and social engineering when they set things like tax policy. I mean, you, on a very basic level, tariffs on, you know, the price of a pint of beer is a form of kind of social engineering through policy. So, in a sense, like, I almost slightly reject the question because it's you almost can't not do it. Like, on some level, that's just how society is structured, I guess.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's a good moment to bring in our philosopher.
Yeah. Just to get back to what Neil said earlier, the fact that we are seeing consequences and now we are starting to think about we should be ethical in our designs. So one of the things I try to get my students is to think about what could possibly happen, what could possibly be the consequences before it happens. I think this is why we need ethical education and critical thinking in data science, in computer science, and also talking about AI, not the kind of AI maybe Neil and Martin are talking about, strictly speaking, but the kind of AI that is ubiquitous, that influences our everyday life. It's a little bit different from yours. They do affect people's lives, and to give you an example, you've probably heard of it, ProPublica's case where they were using algorithms to determine whether someone is likely to commit crime or not, and so many investigations later, they found out the black algorithms by nature are black boxes, even for those AI experts who designed them. And so many experts and so many critics and so much work later, they have decided that the algorithm that have been used over many years, that has affected many people's lives, was racist and sexist, and it was judging people differently for exactly the same crime, and now it has been stopped. So we don't have to go through that phase. We don't have to affect so many lives. We have to think about these things in advance. And this one of the reasons this becomes a problem is that the AI industry is very homogenous. It mainly contains white, you know, European men. So look at soap dispensers not being able to recognize dark-colored skins. You've probably seen the video. It went viral. I'm sure the people who designed those, they didn't say, I don't want black people to get hands soap for their hands. Yeah. I'm sure they didn't do that on purpose. But we need diversity in these huge tech companies, in our computer science departments. And we have face recognition algorithms that don't recognize black people's face. We don't have to wait for these things to happen. We need to diversify our tech industry and think critically and think ethically.
I think that's important for businesses as well, because in recent years I've seen so many examples of Silicon Valley startups that have done things like, oh, there's the famous example of the $400 juicer. someone's bought one there. There was another one I saw the other day, which was somebody who apparently they were trekking in the Himalayas, and they saw that some people in villages didn't have access to clean water. So they set their sort of big tech mind to creating a much more efficient water filtering system. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it retailed for something like $300 again. And it's like, well, it's ridiculous. Like, you've just got a bunch of people who have almost no experience of a huge chunk of the world, even in the suburbs of their own city in San Francisco, let alone what, you know, the needs and wants of people in other countries or other nations. And it's really, really damaging for those businesses. And you know, you see, we're in a situation now where people can walk into a VC office with, you know, a PowerPoint slide that says blockchain on it and walk out again with $5 million. And my serious, you know, try it, you know, seriously. And my serious concern is we're sort of heading for a real bubble again in you know, the sheer disconnect between the thinking around products that people actually want and need and would buy and this bubble of very strange people riding around on motorized scooters in San Francisco.
Well, no, can I get you in there? Because you're our inside man. And we're not.
I do have a motorized scooter.
It's important not to pretend that we're talking about a faceless, anonymized.
We're talking about Neil.
mathematically generated algorithm. We're talking about people who make algorithms, and should we trust in them? And is that landscape changing?
I think it's interesting. I mean, I'd like to connect some of the things that were said, actually. There's a danger in assuming just because you get diverse people, this is going to fix it. I don't think that's going to fix it. I mean, this problem around... the point Martin was sort of saying... I mean, I'm not saying we shouldn't. I love diversity for many good reasons. It actually might accelerate innovation. So it may be more dangerous to have diverse groups of people making successful products instead of crap products that no one buys and failing businesses, because diversity does lead to success and innovation. But let me pull back and talk about what we're deploying. There's a fundamental issue, which I think relates to some of what Martin was saying earlier about why are these algorithms getting worse? Why is Twitter getting worse? Why is Facebook getting worse? If you deploy a system like this, you are deploying... So in that sense, you are deploying algorithmic things that are consistent and repeatable. And the reason, and as I said, the point I was making was kind of humans that interfered with these systems, not algorithms, because you can find the weak points. This happened to Google in the early days as well. The reason they do all sorts of things to their initial algorithm was called PageRank. It was very simple, wonderful algorithm. It looked at the linkage of the internet. It it extracted the smallest eigenvector of the internet. Which is equivalent to the largest eigenvector of the inverse matrix of the internet, which would be impossible to compute, and it ranked pages according to that, and it worked wonderfully well. And then people knew how it was working, so they started gaming it, because it's one algorithm, and if people go to your page, you make a lot of money. And when people start gaming it, then people are gaming it this way, I have to put this in. You know, they spent enormous amounts of time adding things, as Martin was saying, around also the Wikipedia thing. For ages, answers.com, which was just a mirror site for Wikipedia, was higher up than Wikipedia, which was bizarre. I mean, it was a number of years ago. Now, all that's going on is the same thing. When you've got an algorithm that decides what your ads ranking is or what your page rank is or any of these things, humans are pretty clever. You only require a few trials to see what its weak point is, and then you can start messing with it. And now these companies have to give a response. So, you know, to the point about diversity, the big challenge is the thing, as I was trying to point out before, the thing that you deploy with an artificial intelligence is one very large algorithm that performs in the same way. So regardless of who it's being prejudiced against, even if we get everyone to sort of say, oh, look, we can see that this one is conforming to GDPR in terms of it's not discriminating on the basis of race, sex, or religion, or health, which I think is the four protected categories for discrimination, it will perhaps start discriminating, as an example I use, against cyclists. And then all of a sudden they're pushed out of society. No, you don't know.
I'm making a passive offence for cyclists, but let's get Martin, because you had a critique.
It's just like, I mean, you know, I'm sure your eigenvector thingy was beautiful. but if it can be beaten by, you know, Joe MAGA hat-wearing person from Kansas, then maybe it's not as clever as you originally thought.
No one said it. I was saying it's not clever, it's fragile. That's exactly the point I was making. Yeah. These systems are fragile because they're predictable. And the people who are designing these things can't consider every corner case because it's in an uncontrolled environment.
No, but if you have a more diverse group of people considering it in the first place, you tend to get more different answers about how these things go wrong. You look at social media, for example,
I love diversity, but I really think people are very mistaken if they think this will be fixed by diversity.
What about Wikipedia?
I don't think it'll be fixed.
Wikipedia is the example I remember, that Wikipedia, happening in the last year or so, they've had this campaign to recruit women entering more female biographies and data into Wikipedia and people of colour. That seems to be a concerted effort to counter the fact that the gatekeepers of that Wikipedia data are largely geeky, men of a certain complexion and age.
I think that's a different thing, and I think that's very true, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Wikipedia is very much a cultural reflection, but it's much more a social thing. The point I'm trying to make with this is is different from that. Wikipedia's many people editing in parallel, something that everyone can see. The point I'm trying to make is, even if you have a diverse group of people, there's a lovely diverse group of people here, if we design an algorithm, it bottlenecks through that algorithm. And that algorithm itself is not diverse. Why we value diversity in society is because many of us make different decisions about things faced with different information. That's very difficult to game. Let me give you an example. Driverless cars. If we have driverless cars that we know won't crash into you, we will have chaos because everyone will walk out in front of them. The reason that doesn't happen is because no one trusts humans to not crash into you. So as soon as you get these non-diversities, even if they're safe, you get these dangerous behaviors occurring. And as we introduce more and more of this into uncontrolled society, it's phenomenological. It can't be fixed by, oh, let's think about different things, because whatever you deploy will have this flaw.
Okay, it's not driverless cars that I'm concerned about, that only a tiny minority of people are going to own and control. My concern is these huge algorithms, these huge softwares deployed by profit companies that work for profit, whose aims are just efficiency and making money, making profits at the cost of fairness, at the cost of, they don't care if it's discriminatory or not, as long as they are making money. But can I also say, all these problems or racial issues or sexism that have been pointed out are by minority people, by black women, and without their help, without their work, we wouldn't even see whether algorithms are being fair or not, because people see algorithms, they just take them as neutral, something that's that can't have opinions or values.
I need to clarify, also, I am absolutely not arguing that white men should design these things. I'm just saying that the diversity doesn't fix the problem, it's still there.
It does to some extent.
I think nobody thinks that, and I think it's getting heated and interesting. And I want to check that our audience, us, are NI, not AI. So I'm going to throw open to them. They might throw us to the dogs. There might be some Daleks too. We've got a roving mic, so perhaps you can raise your hand if you have questions. But my plan is to try and take three at a time. So are there questions? There are. So there's a gentleman there.
Yes, just to take it away from the heated environment that we're getting into. I've got a question. I'd like to direct it to Neil initially, although others may have. You were talking a while ago about how in the realm of machine learning, we start off with a controlled environment in order to minimize the things that we have to deal with and be able to target the machine to do its particular task. But what about genetic algorithms, where basically you simply maybe design three or four different algorithms, and then you effectively take the ones that get the best result and swap parameters with each other in a way that mimics sexual reproduction, if you like. Add a few mutations at random, and then keep breeding these until you actually get something that comes up with a consistently good result. Now, you're not going to know what you've got. You know what it does. You'll have an algorithm that actually produces a great result of some sort, but because of the way it's been developed, nobody designed it, and you won't know how it does what it does or why, or how to adjust it if it's not doing it properly. So basically, I'd like to ask you, what do you think about the dangers or the benefits of such types of machine learning based on that principle?
Okay, another question along there. Thank you.
Thank you. I've got a question for Abiba, and I'm so sorry if I mangled your name. My question is about racism in machine learning. I was just wondering if you think it's more a racist world using these and then it spits out racism, or if the lack of diversity in tech companies, which I feel like is really well documented, is more responsible for that. And I was looking at your site where it's like when you put into Google autocomplete, you know, black women, dot, 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 it spits out a ton of racist stuff. I remember I was looking for an op-ed, and I was like, liberals should, and it was like, the first one was die, kill themselves. I was like, oh my god, I mean, but is that more because like people are searching for that? or is it cause...
Most tech companies are filled with liberals, actually.
And we've got another question further down.
Oh, thank you. Funnily enough, my question follows on pretty much from the one at the back, is that in the 1980s there was symbolic... there were expert systems which were explanatory. As the gentleman at the back has said, there is now genetic algorithms, but also neural networks are not explanatory because they're a mixture of weights, input data, etc. So that opacity, for example, when an insurance, let's say an insurance has been refused or a loan has been refused or something, the issues of fairness, the issues of lack of explanatory nature, etc. So two questions in that. One that I'll wrap up with the gentleman at the back because I think the first question is aligned. And the second question is a more technical question, probably mainly for Neil, probably Abiba and Neil, is do you think there's been any progress in explanatory tools for that kind of ML? I mean, I see a few on GitHub, and I'm beginning to mess around with things that look like they might be a bit explanatory, but we'd really badly need that.
Okay, great. So the questions were genetic algorithms, can we predict the outcome of an algorithm? Is there racism in the world or in the tech companies, so I paraphrase? And then neural networks, so is there any progress in the explanatory tools for machine learning? Any takeaways?
So there's a conference called FAT, which is Fairness, Accountability, and Transparency in Machine Learning. It's been a big interest of the academic community for a long time, before it became public. There's been understanding of it. It's not generally talked about in the press, but there's a lot of people. There's some really interesting techniques, a lot of which I would characterize as sort of meta-learning. If you think about statistics, we're looking at very complex societies. We're trying to summarize them with sort of simple numbers, which explain what's going on. Well, you can consider applying that to these complex models, that you sort of treat the thing as something you don't fully understand, but you can apply statistical tools for analysis of what the fairness, accountability, and transparency is. And that's a very promising area. And I think we're going to see a lot more of that. I think the GDPR is driving a lot of interest in that. And I think that it's a terrible name, data protection. I prefer to call the GDPR good data practice rules. Because actually, if you can't do the stuff and it's the GDPR about your data, then you probably don't really understand your system very well. And who doesn't want to understand their system to improve it? And on the GAs thing, I think we have to be a bit careful with GAs. GAs are just an optimization technique. They don't really reflect evolution because what happily people do is they define a fitness function. And in machine learning with a neural net, you'd call it an objective function. As you pointed out, neural networks have the same issues of interpretability. The reason GAs don't get you out of this challenge of natural versus artificial systems is that fitness function is mathematically defined, it's unique, and it doesn't change. Whereas in reality, what's our fitness function? How are we going to measure the fitness for people in this room? It's a horrific idea, and it's an idea that led to eugenics, actually. So the reason that natural populations maintain diversity and the concept of survival of the fittest is a total misnomer that Darwin never even said is because there is no such concept as the fitness, because the fitness function is undefined. Diversity is because of the uncertainty in the world and the uncertainty about what we should be doing. And that's uncertainty breeds diversity. And the problem with a lot of these techniques is there's no uncertainty in the fitness.
The question about whether the tech industry is racist or not. I think racism has always been around and it's nothing new. But if your input is racist, your output is going to be racist. If you build your algorithms or your software, whatever, based on historical data, you embed and you perpetuate already existing racism and sexism. And what's happening now is... say in the case of before decision making without algorithms, we have a person making the decision that can be held accountable, that's responsible. Whereas now, because it's algorithms, we have algorithms did it, there is no accountability, or accountability and responsibility is diffused, and we have this false or illusion, illustic perception that algorithms are neutral. They are not. If you give them historical data, they embed and perpetuate whatever historical problems we have, and they spit that out.
So again, on the sort of, is the tech industry racist?
Your question was, is the world racist, or is Is it the tech, and it's just reflecting that? Is it the tech? Yeah. Which one's the biggest devil?
So let me come back to the fun argument we were having before the Q&A started. Nobody is saying... Neil, I'm sorry. Nobody is saying that diversity like magically fixes algorithms. So that argument's fine. We're all right. Equally, I think it's sort of not enough to say that, you know, just because we have algorithms and they can be gamed, therefore we couldn't have done a lot more to deal with these problems and head them off in the first place. And when you look at why we didn't head them off, that's where I think the issues around diversity in the tech industry a real problem. If you take Facebook as an example, Mark Zuckerberg was a 20-something-year-old kid, white male, rich family, prestigious university, incredibly privileged guy, who came up with a philosophy around the idea of radical transparency. And he believed that, you know, if all your data was open, if people just knew what you were doing, then all the things that we're embarrassed about, that we tend to keep private, wouldn't matter so much. And that in this kind of brave new world, you know, you could just put all your information on the internet and it wouldn't be so much of a problem. And that's the kind of thing that you can really only believe if you're a privileged 23-year-old white kid from Harvard. Like, if you're anyone in almost any other group, you have all kinds of reasons why that's not the case. And so he built this system based on that fundamental principle, and that system has now become the basis of a social network of 2 billion people. And so that's, you know, without necessarily saying X is racist, which I think is a really reductive way of putting it, that lack of understanding of the world that is inherent in a community of people that has such a limited view of the world is a major problem. And you see this again and again and again in company after company. Most of the big tech companies, the problems they come up with are things that in a lot of cases other people would have thought of. But they just didn't, because they just didn't have that diversity of opinion or background in those companies from the start.
And now we're all violently agreeing with each other. Can I ask you a bit about gaming an algorithm as a complete amateur? How do you... Can someone like me game an algorithm? Can I outwit an algorithm? I'm trying to book my holiday at the moment, and I know that if I go to those online booking systems, if I go in too often, they start to fix the numbers and they overcharge me for my holiday. And I've heard that there was ways about... that's just an example, but is there a way for someone like me to outwit an algorithm?
I think that's why I like the driverless car example. When they put them on the street, then you'll be able to outwit it by walking in front of it.
So I have to risk it.
And you can see that the consequences are genuinely that you won't be able to integrate driverless car traffic with pedestrians. You'll need... And this is my worry, actually, to be frank, is that the consequences, we become less free, because we have to cater for this system that requires us to behave in a certain way. I mean, railways do that, right? And we accept that we don't run on railways. But when that comes into the city centre, what does that mean?
But the thing is, you say that, but we already have that with cars.
No, we have that with cars.
Even
no,
driverless, like, no, we've completely reconfigured.
No, it's absolutely true. I'm not saying that this is anything massively new. We have it again and again. What you see is as the computer needs us to perform for it, because it doesn't have this wonderful natural flexibility we have. It can do certain things efficiently, and then we have to complete the loop on other things. And distributing people around cities, and it isn't going to be rich people. It will be a wonderful thing, because if it exists, because everyone will have access to transport and will reduce the number of cars, parked cars on the road, if it works. But that requires massive coordination and all sorts of rules about how we're going to treat those roads. Yeah. It's very complex.
I'm just distressed.
Crash test dummies.
I'm going to get a cheaper holiday, but let's get three more questions in if we can. So there's a question right at the front here.
Hi, thank you. On the note of blockchain, one of the applications that's been touted for is its potential to record information for identity building, like psycho and biometrics, social media behavior, and regularity of remittances. So that could mean that dashboards of an individual's information could be used as a standard even for creditworthiness. So I wanted to ask if you see this identity information aggregation as autonomy granting to the individual or deeply problematic in its implications.
Hello. I would like to ask Abiba about that algorithm that was used in US, I think. I think it was called Compass, right?
Yeah, Compass.
And it's only used in US, right, at the moment?
Yeah, but there are many more now.
Yeah, so you see in the future some broad use of this kind of algorithms that are basically predicting your sentence and so on.
Yeah.
And like, do you think it's like some morally justifiable to use such a kind of softwares? Thank you.
Hi, I have a question. I want to take the conversation out of the tech industry. And my question is, can data be used in some kind of like more philanthropical way for philanthropy? Because there are some conversations on open data and crowdsourcing, and I'm curious to know what you think of that and what the implications are.
So, question about blockchain, whether it grants autonomy, whether it has implications, the Compass algorithm, and philanthropy. Can we use data for philanthropic reasons?
Maybe the first question, whether putting all our activities online, making it all open, whether that grants us autonomy and freedom, or whether it's a problem. I have a feeling you might disagree, but for me, it's I see it more as invasion of privacy. They have a new system now in China, the social credit system, I think, where people are rated who they hang around with, or what kind of job they do, or what college they went, and based on that, their social status is established. And I don't think we are far from that here, because you like something on Facebook and you see some ads follow later on because of that, and you participate in a social in some sort of activism, and you go looking for a job, and you worry that because everything you do is out open in the air, because we have become so transparent as a society, because everything we do is that it has a digital trace, we are becoming more cautious, more risk-averse. We don't express our freedoms because we worry that whatever we do will impact our future, what we do. So I see it as more of invading our freedom, as a lack of the freedom to be forgotten, rather than granting us autonomy.
I think that's certainly right. I think that my big fear about, people get very excited about blockchain and data. As Abiba said, you know, we value forgetting. Actually, the reason I tell my doctor things is because he probably won't bother to remember it, because why does he care? But if you've got everything in a blockchain of your entire history, and then this relates to open data as well. Open data is great, but certain data, have that characteristic that you lose privacy. I kind of have a vague inkling that personal data becomes much more important freedom. The more you think about it, because it's about control of your self-identity, your virtual identity, and as that encroaches on the real world, that becomes control of yourself in the real world. I think Shadiba mentioned loss of free will, and I think there's really interesting aspects, like if the computer knows you better than you know yourself, and the only control you have against that is some sort of ownership of your data within your sphere. I have lots more on that, but I want to let Martin speak.
Yeah, I think the first important thing to say is that if you take that blockchain question, put it on a PowerPoint slide and walk into a VC's office, you'll probably walk out with £5 million. So that's worth thinking about. I'm a little bit skeptical of blockchain because I have yet to actually see an application of it that kind of makes any sense and does anything that can't be done by other means, but that's like a whole other thing. I think taking those questions together about sort of data and how it's used, again, I think there's the point that we're sort of at the tail end of this long history of people making decisions about us based on data that is held that we do not necessarily have good sight of. Credit reference agencies have been around for donkey's years and significantly affect how much money we can spend, what services we can get access to. Go back 150 years and it was people with beards like mine sitting in clubs that were deciding, who could do what and instituting these kinds of hierarchies on society. So in a way, it's like we're at this transition point into a new set of systems doing the same kind of thing, which I think is what makes it interesting when we're talking about how to build those systems. I think as well, there's this kind of social contract that people were willing to give up their data to Facebook and were actually quite happy for that to be used for advertising and so on, as long as they felt they were getting something good in return. And it's when that relationship breaks down, when people start to lose faith in Facebook and the other services they're using, that they also seem to become a bit more concerned about the data that they have on those platforms. One of the interesting things we're trying to do at PacMatter is kind of turn that relationship with data around a bit. So the data that we want to gather from the news platform we're building would then be used to actually tackle fake news by, you know, providing advertisers with ways to avoid bad and malicious content on the internet, which is sort of moving away from this model of, you know, oh, we're just going to get masses of data and sell it, to something where it's, we're going to accumulate data and we're going to actually use that data for some kind of social good. Or, you know, I mean, obviously it makes us money too, we're not philanthropists, but it's you know, we're doing something and you know, that's actually having a practical you know, benefit in the real world. And
good algorithms to catch the bad algorithms.
Yeah, and I think we'll see more companies like that in the future. I think there's probably a bit of a market there for kind of, just as, you know, we now have alternatives to McDonald's that are like, you know, buy vegetables and eat salads and, you know, be really healthy. I wonder if we'll start to see that in the tech space as well.
Just that to get back to the Compass question, should we use algorithms to determine whether someone is likely to recommit crime or not? I think there are so many questions and so many factors in order to answer that question, because for starters, these algorithms are developed by private companies with profit and efficiency in mind, and in designing those algorithms, they don't usually account for our historical biases, and our historical biases carry on to our machines, to our algorithms. And it also comes down to the objective of that algorithm, or the objective that society wants to get out of those algorithms. Do we just want to count prisoners' numbers, or do we want our objective to be look into why we have so many crimes, look into how we can improve you know, a certain demographics that we are focusing our surveillance on, and maybe provide some solution as to how prison numbers can be reduced. Though the private companies that design these sort of algorithms, they don't care about that. They don't think about that. They don't question that. They have some intuitions, they gather data, and they use that data to prove and to kind of justify their own intuitions, and the feedback loop goes on and on and on. And if our aims and objectives become to serve the disadvantaged, to find a solution for a high rate of imprisonment, maybe we would have a better idea of what kind of algorithms we need.
I think this is a nice note to end. Neil, I'm going to give you the last word, because we've been talking about, I think we picked up that last question about whether the algorithm can be deployed for a social good.
Mm.
Is that the future, do you think? Can you see that happening?
Oh, it's my passionate belief. I mean, the reason I worry about all these things is I know that the good that these things can do, particularly in health. And health is a sector we haven't talked much about, it, but it's one where everything is distilled. The benefits, you know, I've just watched my brother die. And so much of this can be stopped with the right information. And we must never lose sight of that. A lot of misery can be stopped. I mean, I do a lot of work in with Data Science Africa. So much good can be done. But if we make errors in terms of the way we're doing these things and laying them down, then, you know, we'll lose the confidence of the public, and we won't be able to deploy these wonderful things that we can do.
It sounds like we've got ambition. That's a good place for us to end. Can I encourage you, Natural Intelligence, to join me in thanking our really brilliant guests?